Good evening, everyone. You're tuned in to another session of Fight Back on E-Radio Broadcast Network. I am your host, Charles Lewis, coming to you live from Barbados, all the way in the Caribbean. And if you do not believe me, just listen carefully and you're going to hear the sounds of the crickets, which is actual proof that I'm in the tropics. Today is the 24th of June, 2011, and the time in Barbados is 7:30 p.m. In New York, without the crickets, it's 7:30 p.m. And in London, or jolly old England, it is 12:30 a.m., wee hours in the morning. In this session of Fight Back, my guest is Rachel Grant. Rachel is a trauma recovery and relationship coach from California in the United States and is here this evening to share her resources, personal stories, communication techniques, and strategies for improving relationships, communication, and overcoming sexual abuse. This is a live interactive broadcast, and we invite the listeners to participate in the discussion. If you have any questions or comments about today's topic, please call us on 1-347-855-8239. You can also join the discussion via Skype. The call-in number and Skype button both appear at the top of the show page. Thank you for tuning in to Fight Back on E-Radio Broadcast Network, and I hope you enjoy the discussion. Good evening, Rachel. How are you doing this evening?
Hi, Charles. I'm doing well. Doing just fine.
Good, good. Thank you very much for joining us on Fight Back. Normally, I contact my guests 10, 15 minutes before the show so that we can get acquainted and do a bit of briefing and so on. We didn't have that time, but you sound more calm than I am, because I had a hell of an evening, Rachel. Everything that could have gone wrong went wrong. Couldn't get my headset to work. I had to delete Skype and reinstall it again because it just wouldn't configure with my headset. Everything went wrong. Oh my God. I was like, I was wondering, am I going to be able to have the show with Rachel? Rachel is going to kill me.
Oh my, no, of course not. I think that's a small price you pay for living in Barbados, right? I mean, there has to be something go wrong for you every once in a while.
That's right. If not for the crickets in the background to calm me down. You see, I don't have a coach or a counselor, you see, so I need a cricket to help me.
That'll work. We can always do something about that. I'm still for hire.
Good. Okay. We'll talk about it. Okay. Now, everyone that I've interviewed on this show has had a fascinating story to tell, and although the causes are similar, the experiences are all unique, and certainly in the impact that they've had on the survivor. Now, in your bio, you refer to your own personal experience with sexual abuse, and which became the catalyst to your career path. I appreciate that it's difficult talking about these things, but would you kindly tell us a bit about this encounter you had with sexual abuse, which led to the person you are today?
Yeah, sure. Well, so I grew up in a small town in Oklahoma, lived with my mom and dad and grandfather. I was the youngest of three. But by the time I was about 10 years old, my two older siblings were already on out of the house. And so it was just us. And around the age of 10 was when my grandfather began sexually abusing me. And it was just, looking way back on it now, being so far from it, I still get the sensation of, that sucked. That was a really rough and miserable moment when it started being terrified, confused.
Yeah, how old were you again? I'm sorry, how old were you?
Oh, 10.
10, okay. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And, and it just kind of threw everything into a tailspin. I was very kind of nurturing, cuddly, fun, bubbly little girl, and I just remember starting to retreat.
Okay.
And, kind of pulling away from everybody and not really sure why people couldn't figure out something was wrong, really upset about that part of it, why doesn't anyone just look at me and know that something has changed and that I'm suffering?
Did you reach out for help at that time? Or maybe I should ask you, did, at that age, I mean, it's, you're old enough to know that there's something wrong with this behavior. Did you did you get that feeling, and did you cry out for help?
Well, here's the thing, you know, as children, when we're abused, we don't have the capacity to rationally think through what's happening to us. Mm-hmm. You know, we know something bad is going on, but at the same time, we're terrified of saying anything about it. We're not sure if we're the ones that are at fault, if we're making it happen. And the one thing we do know as children is that when you do something bad, you get in trouble.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times children don't say anything just because of that simple childlike rationale. It's like the same as putting your hand in the cookie jar. You know if you get caught, you're going to get punished. And so
I want you to help me understand something. I mean, I've spoken to quite a few people on and off air about their experiences. As a child, 10 years old, if someone took away your money at school, you're going to scream bloody murder. Because you know it's wrong, and or if someone took away something that you know hurt your dog, or some, you know you'll run to the police. You'll run. How is it that when a child is sexually abused, what is it about sexual abuse that causes them to retreat more so than the reaction they would normally have if someone stole their money or hurt their favorite pet? What explain that to the listeners? Explain it to me.
Well, I think one of the first elements that makes it difficult is the fact that oftentimes the highest percentage of abusers are somebody who you know intimately, personally. It's a family member.
Mm-hmm.
So you're struggling to understand how this person who you trusted is doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You don't immediately recognize the adult as doing something bad or wrong because adults are supposed to be good. Adults are supposed to protect you. And so if this is happening, then it just must be normal, right?
That makes so much sense. So much sense. As a matter of fact, the moment when you started to explain it right away, I got where you were going. And yes, it makes total sense. Okay, continue. Tell us what happened after that, the point where it started to happen. And
Sure. So, you know, the abuse continued for a while, and I basically just kind of kept to myself and did the best I could to kind of avoid, you know, interacting with him and, you know, avoiding crossing paths.
Of course,
Until, you know, eventually one day my mom basically walked in and saw what was going on.
Okay.
And kind of immediately pulled me away. But, you know, the interesting thing about this moment, Charles, is one that I talk a lot about with my clients because in that moment, she yelled at me, you know, Rachel, get over here. It was just like a child being scolded. And one of the things that people, children particularly who have been abused, struggle with are the ideas and the thoughts and the stories that they then begin to understand about who they are that are confusing or negative. And most of the work that you end up doing after the abuse stops is actually dealing with all of that stuff. And in that moment when my mom kind of walked in and snatched me away, but did it in that same kind of way that you would if, you know, I was, you know, beating up the dog.
Yes.
I really got that it was my fault. And that idea kind of got created in that moment, that story, as I like to call them. It's my fault.
What was her reaction to your grandfather?
She kicked him out. She was great. You know, she got him out of there. She got, you know, got a lot of distance. She really tried to support me and get me into counseling, but I wasn't having it. I pushed back, and I didn't want to talk to anyone. I didn't want to really have to face what had happened.
Yes.
And it took me many, many, many years before I did talk to anyone. I suffered for a long time before I owned up to the story.
How did it affect you in school, in your teenage years and beyond?
Well, the interesting thing is that for me, I think all children who are abused usually find something that they can excel in because they want to have something that they feel good about. And they'll be struggling in lots of ways. I was very immature emotionally, but I excelled in school. And that's really where I put a lot of my effort. And I just achieved, and mm-hmm. pushed myself and did really well there. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't, you know, popular. I wasn't an in crowd. My experience, I always say, is I kind of always felt like the kid who had been pushed to be, you know, 20 or 30 well before her time. And so a lot of my girlfriends would be hanging around talking about, you know, the cutest boy on TV or whatever. And I just couldn't relate to that. I think there's a...
Yes, go on.
Think there's a kind of a break that happens when you've been sexually abused or abused in any way. You see the world through this very different lens
Would you say there's a disconnect between you, your emotions, and perhaps boys? I mean, because I'm going to ask you now about relationships. What was dating like for you?
Well, dating really took on the whole same feeling of abuse. It was about obligation. It was about being there to meet the needs of somebody else and not being tuned in to my own needs. Mm-hmm. A lot of, you know, adult women in particular struggle with sexual intimacy because they haven't yet been able to make that connection that or break the connection between the sexuality that occurred with the abuser and their adult sex life. And so they keep sex in this little package of obligation and, you know, difficult and bad and wrong. And I do a lot of work with that because I think that's one of the areas that is most impacted and most unique about people who've been sexually abused. Beyond the emotional, beyond the mental, you actually do have to do the work of figuring out, you know, your sexuality. So, you know, through my teen years, through my 20s, I just, you know, kind of bounced around, had a rough time, couldn't, constantly wanting somebody to just, like, get me and know me, but looked for it in all the wrong places, of course.
Mm-hmm. There's a thought. There is also... Well, I've heard quite often that people who have been abused as a child, they tend to gravitate towards abusive relationships, abusive men, partners. Is there any connection with your reaction to your experience and that consideration?
Well, so here's the way I look at those sorts of things. Definitely I had that experience, but the reason why I think that happens is because when you have a traumatic experience, all of us, no matter what the traumatic experience is, we want to understand why it happened. We need to figure out the reasoning. And most often, what we do is blame ourselves. We figure out what we are, what it is about us that caused it. So people who come out of an abusive relationship or an abusive experience come out with all sorts of ideas, like, I deserved it, I'm worthless, I can't do anything right, it's my fault. So those are not idle thoughts. Those are actually on a neurological level, like in the mind, the way that your brain has now been wired to respond to situations. And so you basically go out looking. It's like the brain wants to be fed. And so you find yourself in situations where that wiring can be reinforced.
Yes.
And people who are abusers are wonderful at reinforcing it, you know. They're right there ready. They're happy to do it.
Yes,
know?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, part of my work and part of my own journey has been attacking that wiring, figuring mm-hmm. out how to break those connections and mm-hmm. build new connections that are positive, mm-hmm. that are reinforcing.
Yeah.
And you know, finding part the stability and the strength. Go ahead.
Yeah, part of your journey obviously was making the transition from victim to survivor. Do you remember that point?
Yeah, so I definitely remember that point and then another point, which I'll talk a little bit about, because to me there are three stages of recovery. I think it's a very powerful and important movement that occurred when people started championing this idea of we're survivors, we're not victims. And the distinction for me is the victim is somebody who is still really in it. They're suffering. They haven't escaped the abuse. They're being victimized, right? And they're carrying on the abuse. Even if they're away from it, they're carrying on the patterns and the beliefs that were created. The survivor is somebody who is finally able to sit down and say, this is part of my story. This is what I felt. This is what I experienced. I'm starting to see the connections between, you know, maybe why I always get angry about this or why I, you know, can't connect with men over here. Or they're starting to see all of that. But I remember making that transition, you know, probably in my mid-20s. I really got serious about thinking about it, looking at it. I'm not going to avoid it. I want to understand what happened. Mm-hmm. But then, up to the point where I understood all of these things, but I kept making the same mistakes. I kept going around the same mountain, and I got so sick of it. And somebody said to me, you know, but you're a survivor, you're doing great. And I just remember saying, you know what? I don't want to survive my life. I want to live it. And that is the moment when I discovered what I think is the third stage of recovery, which is what I call beyond surviving. So I describe myself as a beyond survivor.
That is an amazing observation. That is so interesting what you just said, because up until now, I've only interviewed people who were victims, became survivors, but I've not, you're the first person to enlighten me on stage three, and it makes so much sense listening to you. I quite agree with you, and I commend you for arriving at that third stage. Tell us about the transition from two to stage three, to limited life to its fullest.
So that stage three is when you basically say to yourself, all right, I get it. I know why I do all these things, but now I need to know how to stop it. Right? You're like,
okay,
all right, I'm done.
Okay.
And you're kind of ready to give up the abuse as your favorite excuse for why you do things. And the way I describe it is, you know when you fall and you scrape your knee?
Yes.
And you get that, you know, it's bloody, it's gushing, it's nasty. You know, some people say when you're in that survivor stage, that's when you reopen the wounds, you're looking at it. And then it heals over, and you can look at the scar, and you remember that's what happened, but you don't have any of the same pain or discomfort or anxiety about it. And that's stage three of beyond surviving. It's you know that you were abused. You know that that's part of your experience. You know that there are certain things about you that are that way because of what happened, but you're not constantly trying to manage and maneuver around or adapt to deal with patterns and behaviors.
Interesting. Did you ever confront your abuser, your grandfather, after that time?
He actually, the summer after, you know, the abuse ended, I was away at summer camp, and he died while I was away. And the counselor came and asked me, you know, do you want to go home and, you know, go to this funeral? And I didn't. I stayed at camp, and I played and went swimming in the creek, and it was amazing.
How old were you when he passed away? How old were you?
So it was the summer after, so it was about 11.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Just a year. Yeah. Just a year later. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of a quick. Yeah, he made his exit pretty soon after that, and and that was tough. You know, one of the things that survivors often deal with is, do I confront? Do I not confront? And what do I do if the person who abused me is a stranger and they're just long gone, or a family member who's, you know, passed away? And you know, I work with a lot of my clients around that, not only preparing them for what it actually really means to confront the abuser, like what the purpose of it is, but how to kind of protect themselves and be really ready and sturdy for that moment. And for myself, the confrontation was more a matter of, you know, writing a letter, you know, using my imagination to just say what it is I would have wanted to say to him now, you know, as a mature adult looking back and being able to really think about what needed to be said in order to release, you know.
Now that you have so much experience, so much knowledge and understanding of what happened to you as a child and going through the stages of recovery, and now you're a qualified coach, do you look back and regret not being able to confront him?
No, not at all. I think that the thing about abuse, and no matter what kind of abuse, is that the person who did it, at a certain point in recovery, becomes not the point anymore. He became the trigger. He became the instance. But, you know, that abuse happened, you know, over like 6 months to a year. But then it was from 11 until 26 or so where I was the abuser. I was doing the abuse. I was repeating the patterns. I was, you know, reinforcing the negative thoughts.
Okay,
I was going after the bad stuff, you know. I was not setting boundaries or respecting who I was. I basically just kind of took the baton from him and kept going.
And abused yourself, okay, because I was wondering. I thought you were running around the streets and attacking people. Okay, you were abusing yourself. Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And that really is the trauma. To me, that is the sadness of abuse, is that the abusers go away. You know, unless it's a real close family member, like a parent, where you are going to probably have to continue to interact with them sometime, a lot of time the abuser is long gone, but we just say, yeah, I'll take over for you. And that, to me, is the sadness of the experience. And what I grab people by their shoulders and shake them, like, let's stop doing this to yourself. And forgive, place the blame where it belongs, but also recognize that you're in charge of your choices now. You don't have to remain, you know, stuck or held back by what happened.
There's another person involved here, and that is your mother. You did not mention anything about your father. But what about the dynamic between you and your mother after that point, up until now, perhaps? What was the dynamic like, or what is the dynamic like?
So my dad was pretty amazing. You know, I always felt pretty sheltered and secure with him. But I do remember withdrawing from him a bit, not because of anything he did. I just had my own thoughts about what he must think of me, you know, how weird this must be for him.
Was it his father or your mother's father?
It was my mom's, yeah.
Okay.
Okay. And my mom definitely struggled with that for a long time, and that caused her a lot of pain and guilt. And I think it was something like in my mid-20s where we were having a conversation about what happened, and she just kind of casually said, oh, you know, that one time. And it clicked, and I realized my mom didn't really even know the whole story. She thought that day was the only time. And here's the thing, you know, one time is enough.
Of course.
I always say there's no competition in trauma. Like, if you're abused once, it counts. You know, your abuse counts as much as somebody else who went through it for years.
Yes.
But it just really, it astounded me that we had gone through pretty much all of my teens and early 20s with this complete disconnect about what my experience had been, who I was as a result. I was pretty much a terror as a teenager, so they had their hands full. And they really did the best they could. And, you know, I chat with my mom pretty much once a week now, and we're close enough, you know. And my dad passed when I was 18. So, you know, I didn't have him much longer.
How did you regard men? Well, the boys as a teenager, and then as you became older, how did you regard and still regard? Well, not still, because you sound like you are totally beyond the survivor stage. I mean, I love the calmer, the sound in your voice. I have no doubt that you're well beyond the survivor stage. But how did you regard boys and then men as you got older in reference to that experience?
Yeah, I think that my view of men was essentially that that there was one way to engage with them, which was physically.
Yes.
And that it was my obligation to do so.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really feel like I had any rights.
Okay.
And and yeah, and that was basically it. It was a very detached. It was what I call. I think it's like a detached longing. Like,
yes.
I want to be close to you, but I want to stay away. I want to be close to you, but I want to stay away.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in my adult relationships, I had one very long 10-year relationship, and that was very difficult and very bad for me. And it was really a lot of that, you know, finding somebody who's going to reinforce all the negative ideas I already had about who I was. And,
yes.
You know, when I broke out of that, and when I really went through a lot of the work to get to that beyond surviving stage, yeah, my perspective of men, it just completely opened up. And I just absolutely adore and, you know, love, you know, who men can be and what
yep.
they can what they could be in interaction, you know, with you and that mm-hmm. dynamic between the male and female and all of that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, tell us about the point you decided to launch your business as a coach.
So in 2007, I, you know, struck that point where I thought, all right, I think I get it now. I think I know what I did. I think I can conceptualize how I got here. And I came up with, you know, the term Beyond Surviving. I was like, all right, let me do this. So I just kind of started working on a curriculum, on a workshop. And I was in a community, and I just took it to the head person and said, hey, I think I want to try to offer this to the women in our community and see if it makes a difference. And so it really started out as just a volunteer thing. And I basically created Beyond Surviving, which is a four-month workshop. For at that time, it was for people who had just been sexually abused and just women. It's right now kind of in the stages of growing out so that it can be available, you know, for different types of abuse and from both men and women, because men do suffer, for sure. And, you know, our statistics are pretty bland as far as what we think we know about men who suffer. I think it's probably much worse. But so I led the workshop, and I did that for 3 years. And then I kind of hit that point where I thought, yeah, maybe I should actually do this for real.
Okay.
I went to school and I got my master's in counseling psychology, and I'm not a licensed therapist, so I don't do therapy, but I wanted the background in human development, cognition, all of those things to bolster my coaching practice.
Okay.
And last year I launched my business. So for a year
Fantastic.
I've been working as a coach.
Fantastic.
And, yeah.
Fantastic. So what is the name of your business? How can we find you? And what services exactly do you offer? I have so
sure.
many questions for you, Rachel, about your business. I hope you're ready for this. Okay.
I am ready. Let's do it.
Good. Okay.
So
yes.
The website is really easy. It's rachelgrantcoaching.com. And I basically do three different sorts of packages. The first is the trauma recovery coaching. And that is a 16-session program. And I basically can take individuals through the Beyond Surviving workshop. So that's one option. The other is relationships. You know, the other area of life that is so important, whether you've been abused or not, is
yes.
how we relate to each other. I often think, you know, I could have done without calculus, but a lesson in, like, relating to other people would have been really helpful. I study it like crazy, and it really is like my heart, and I love like thinking about how people communicate with each other and get along and what messages we send and how we love each other and support each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's basically, you know, the relationship communication program is about a 10-session
yes.
And then there's a build your own option. If you have other things that are going on, like you want relationship stuff, but you also have questions about work, you know, things like that often come up with my clients. It's the whole person, you know, who I'm thinking about and who I'm working with.
Yes.
And they can go on my website and sign up for, you know, a free Discover session. And,
yeah.
you know, for 30 minutes, I'll talk to you and tell you, you know, what I do and find out more about you and how we might be able to work together. And, you know, right now I'm offering all of my new clients 4 free sessions. So that's an amazing feel.
And, yes.
what else can I say to get people to? Yeah, and so, you know, also I wanted to say, if people are listening and they're just interested in some resources, you know, they can always email me, coach
yes.
at rachelgrantcoaching.com. And, you know, I'll send over a little, you know, I can send the key concepts that I cover in Beyond Surviving so they can get an idea of, you know, what we would talk about, some other little activities that I just love that I do with all of my clients.
Yeah.
Happy to do that as well.
Well, people are listening because I have a few questions here by from someone in the United Kingdom. Her name is Gemma. Well, the first question from Gemma, you've answered that, but the question was, how have your personal experiences influenced your choices in your career and then slash future? So we do know how your experiences have influenced your career, but let's talk about the future. Let's give Gemma an answer about what do you see yourself doing in the future based on your past experiences and your experiences now as a coach? What
sure.
are the plans for the future?
Well, I'll tell you, I started out imagining myself to be an English teacher, and that's really where my path started. So it was a windy
yes.
road to kind of get here where I was like, yeah, I can do this work now. I can actually do it and feel like I have something to say and to offer.
Yes.
And I'll tell you, every time on the phone with a client and we're talking and we get to those, like, aha moments and they just get something about themselves that's new and insightful and frees them, you know, that's really living for me. And I would just love to, in the future, you know, build this out so I'm doing it completely full-time. I'm able to do the workshops, like, all over the country. I would love to be able to take Beyond Surviving, you know, so lots of different cities and build it out so I have other people who can lead the group and, you know, just other people out there spreading the word about, you know, stage 3, stage 3 of recovery.
Do you do group sessions or is it one-on-one?
I do. Right now I'm doing individual coaching only. I'm in the process of rewriting the book and a workbook for Beyond Surviving. So once that's finished, I'll be opening up for the workshops again. And I do all of the coaching by phone, so my clients, you know, I have East Coast clients. It's just, you know, figuring out the time zone switches and stuff like that, but we basically talk by phone or by Skype.
Yes. How do your clients come to you? Are you at the point where you're getting referrals now from doctors, from police department? Well, certainly you have a website that should be doing quite a bit for you. What's working mostly for you?
I think definitely word of mouth. Definitely word of mouth. Having, you know, my past clients who, you know, feel like they gained something and that, you know, I offered something of value to them, share, you know, their experience with other people. You know, oftentimes just a Google search for trauma will bring up my website. So some people have found me that way.
Fantastic. Gemma has another question for you. She wants to know what advice could or would you give to people who have not yet taken the first step to seek counseling?
Right.
I said, well, this is after sexual abuse.
That's tough. Yeah. Making that first.
Because you were at that point. At one point, you were advised to take counseling and you refused. So what would you advise someone who's not yet taken that first step and they're not sure, they're shying away from it? What would you say to someone who's listening and this is their experience?
I would say if you're not yet ready to kind of say it out loud, that's the scary part. It's like when you say it out loud, I was sexually abused, I was raped, I was, you know, physically abused. Man, it just takes on a whole new level of power when it's actually your words spoken.
Yes.
And when you're worried about that step, when that's what's holding you back, find some workbooks. Find some things that you can read. You know, Courage to Heal, Shelter from the Storm, a couple of Repair by Margie McKinnon. All of these are really great workbooks to just help you to start thinking about all of the different things that are probably going on for you, Jenna, as a result of what's happened. And that'll start to get you, like, in the space of thinking about it, feeling it. And, you know, we all need a support, and finding somebody to support you, even as you're doing something like that, is really important. So even if you have just one friend who you can go to and say, I'm gonna read this book, and I'm probably going to be freaking out for the next week, but just hold my hand through it, and, you know, let's do it, you know. Find somebody who can go with you to that therapist's office and just sit outside in the lobby waiting with you, you know, for you.
Those I have a thought. Things. Yeah, I'm sorry. I have a thought, and which leads me to a question. When you are giving counseling advice to someone who has been sexually abused, do you find that you are reliving that experience, your experience, through their story, and is that a good thing to do as a counselor? Is it an unwise thing to do? Should it come purely from a professional perspective and not from your personal experience? Is it possible to separate the personal, you know, experience from the, you know, or the personal perspective from the professional perspective?
Well, so one of the things that I'm doing is coaching as opposed to counseling.
Okay.
So the distinction, and the reason why I make that distinction is, first for legal purposes, but also because what I'm listening for is not like your deep, dark past. What I'm listening for is what you're doing today as a result of your deep, dark past. And so I don't relive any of my abuse, because what I'm thinking about is, oh, yeah, I had that thought, too, about I'm not good enough. And I'm hearing it in the person as they're sharing about, like, oh, you know, I really can't sign up for this class, or, you know, I really can't do that. You know, what's underneath that is this story of I'm not good enough, or I'm not capable. And then, you know, a lot of what I do with my clients is talking with them down to the level so they can really get to that level of what the story is. And so I don't share the details. I don't go into any of the nitty-gritty, because that's not where the important part is. The important part is what I made it mean, what I, as a result of the abuse, became to think about who I was, or how I saw the world, or how I saw other people. And in every once in a while sharing little bits of that with other people, they kind of open up a little bit more. And I'm able to pull out what they made it mean, because everybody does something different. You know, there are a few commonalities. The "it's my fault" one is pretty standard across the board. But there are all sorts of unique stories that people walk away with, or ideas or false beliefs that they walk away with because of abuse. And that's what I want to figure out, and that's what I'm going to be pushing at. See, as a counselor, I'd have to just kind of like say, yeah, you know, what do you think about that? How does that make you feel? Or, you know, where do you think that's all connected? But as a coach, I say, all right, this belief is here because this. Do you see that? Does that feel right? Do you relate to that? Now, what are we going to do about it? See, now that's that part. What are we going to do about it?
I'm a little confused, though. There's a great area between the counseling and the coaching, and certainly from the legal perspective. But could you shed some light on that for me and for anyone listening who is just wondering what the difference is?
So the counselor is, one, they're listening to diagnose, right? They're interested in figuring out how you're broken. Yeah, that is one of the things that they are charged with doing, is diagnosing a patient. And the relationship between the counselor and the client is very much the client is, you know, talking, sending information, and the therapist or counselor is, you know, reflecting and, you know, asking questions here or there, but not really pushing. And, you know, know, there are all sorts of fields of therapy as well. So, like, cognitive behavioral therapy is a little bit different. So I would distinguish, I'd pull that out from some of the other schools of therapy. You know, the therapist is interested in feelings, emotions, getting to the past, right? Looking at the past, digging it up, really standing there. As a coach, I'm interested much more in a collaborative communication with my client. It's a client, not a patient. I don't see them as broken. I see them as stuck. I see them as having some false beliefs, some ideas that are getting in the way of them living powerful and fulfilling lives. And we're going to work together to basically unstuck them.
So,
and so we're collaborating. You know, I push an idea out, they push back. I push an idea out, they push back. And I give them homework, like, you're going to do this, and this is what you need to do, and we're going to check back in, and, you know, I'm going to hold you accountable for that, and we're going to make the journey along together and have a conversation.
Do you find that people are more comfortable with a coach than a counselor? Is it an easier sell maybe? Maybe belittling too much, but you know what I mean. I would imagine it's easier for someone to come forward for coaching than counseling. Perhaps the coach might recommend that they go for counseling. There's another point too that I want to mention. There are many more people out there who have suffered sexual abuse, who have not come forward, and it's not known by the authorities, by someone's parent or parents, and many people tend to develop solutions for those who have come forward. But I like the fact that my show can reach out to people as well who have not come forward, and they're listening, and I want to tailor my shows from time to time to reach those individuals. Maybe it would help them to come forward, because you just said something that's very interesting to those who are out there and they're lost. They don't know what to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that therapy and coaching are really amazing ways to get into a conversation about what has happened for you. And depending on where you are in that stage of recovery, I think one suits more than the other. So if I get a client who is really just, it's just too raw. Like, they haven't processed anything. You know, I may take them through one or two sessions just to kind of see what's going on. But if I'm sensing that they're not really kind of at a place where they're stable, I'll ask them to either do counseling along with coaching, or to just go do counseling for a while and then come back to coaching. Because I'm going to push, and I don't want to push somebody who is still very tender, right? So it's easier to come to coaching sometimes if you're, you know, trauma recovery coaching is still kind of hard to come to, because you're like, yeah, I'm going to talk about this tough stuff. And a lot of times what I find is my clients come about relationships, about communication, and by about the sixth session, they say, by the way, Rachel, I had this thing happen.
Yes.
And we switch gears, you know, and that's fine, and that's perfect. It's like in your own timing. You know, we all have our own timing for when we're ready. And beating yourself up because you can't talk about it, or because you still have this, you know, thing that you do, you know, that isn't going to help at all, right? So.
Yes. Well, Gemma is doing a fantastic job of asking questions here. She's making my job a lot easier than I, you know, and I'm very appreciative. She wants to know also, what is the most satisfying aspect of your job?
Well, you know, the moment when somebody gives up a false belief about who they are.
Yes.
When they stop punishing themselves and they recognize that they have a choice, that the thought I'm worthless, the thought I'm not good enough, the thought I don't deserve anything better than this, is simply a thought. And that we have the power through both language and through behavior to modify our thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a great in Buddhism, there's this idea that, you know, language is the source of our character, but it's also a lever for shifting it. And I just love that. I think the power of our voice, we just don't give enough credit to. And, you know, I recently wrote about this in my blog, too, that a lot of times what happens for people who have been abused is you disconnect from your voice. Because, you know, you have to start telling lies. You have to start covering up. And so whenever I'm working with a client and we get to those moments where they say, yep, you know what? I'm done. I'm done beating myself up about that. I'm going to have a new thought. I'm going to have a new experience. And everything that comes after that is just amazing. You know, I remember one woman in my Beyond Surviving workshop, she had this real idea about, like, everything's up in the air. Like, I don't have any choice here. And when we worked around that and she got to that place where, yeah, I can make choices. I have the opportunity and the right to decide the course of my life. She went to medical school. I was like, holy cow, what is this? she walked in, you know, small and, you know, bent over. She had just been raped a year before. And she walked out of there with her head up, and she was off and doing stuff in the world. And, you know, she's married and a mom now. And it's just amazing. That, you know, that just warmed me to the bone.
Yes. You've not said anything about being an advocate. Have you done any work with any of the, you know, organizations dealing with sexual abuse?
Not a lot. I have a connection here with a group called Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. And they're actually across, you know, the country. They have a great support group. It's the 21-step kind of support group. And, you know, I've been to a few of those, and I've talked a bit with the, you know, board president. I'm connected, you know, with a couple of the, you know, organizations in the Bay Area that are working to prevent rape, working to prevent child abuse. And so I'm just kind of getting my feet wet now with those sorts of endeavors. As I build out my business more and have, you know, my individual clients settled and, you know, workshops going, that's definitely, you know, on the table to put more energy and time into.
Yes. What would you say to parents listening to this show? And I should say at this point, we may have 500 or 5,000 people listening, but certainly it grows in time. We could have 25,000 people listen to this show over the next 3 months because it will remain on the website in the archives, and I'm sure you're going to put it on your site because I'm going to provide you with an embed code so that your web traffic can come, go to, you know, can listen to this broadcast directly from your web page. But what would you say to parents listening to this broadcast and wondering what signs should I look for to determine whether or not my child has been, you know, sexually abused by anyone? What would you say to parents listening?
Boy, that's a tough one, because every child does something different. But, you know, some of the cues that are out there and, you know, standard literature would be, does the child's personality just shift? Do they become withdrawn? Do they become anxious or nervous around particular people? Do they change appetite, sleep patterns? Do they regress in behavior? Like if you have a young child, like a, you know, 5 or 6-year-old, do they regress back to being, you know, 3-year-old behavior? Like they aren't able to, you know, go to the potty, or they, you know, suck their thumbs now and those sorts of things. But, you know, to me, the main thing I think parents can do is be open about the conversation. Bring it up with your children. Talk about it. It's not going to scare them. It's not going to scar them. I think that's a misconception that a lot of parents and adults in general have, is that if I tell them people will touch them, oh, my God, that's going to scare the, you know, pudding out of them.
Yes.
And create all these, you know, bad ideas for them. No, it's just as simple as saying, look, this is where your body can be touched. This is where it can't be. No matter who does it, no matter what they tell you about it, this, you just, you know, you come and tell me what's happening. And that ask seems, them.
Yes, that seems to be an area that you could excel in, because I think so many parents need some help in developing their communication skills around this and other delicate subjects. And certainly, communication is one of your areas of expertise, as you mentioned it in this interview, and certainly on your website. But that is interesting. It is down to communication, because each child will react differently, and you're right. It's all about that communication, being able to broach the subject in the right way, because kids tend to. I met a gentleman only 2 days ago at the beach from England, and he was there with his son. A friend of mine, we just happened to sit next to them, and we started to talk about his experience having his son was physically abused by the mother, and he managed to take the son away and protect the son from her, and he now has full control, full custody. Mm-hmm. And he said something which was quite interesting. He said, children don't really listen to you. They learn by watching you, not so much by you telling them. And that made so much sense, you know.
Yeah.
And he said it with conviction, because it has been his experience with his son. You know, I mm-hmm. it's better for me to show my son by example, not by telling him. And it made so much sense. So yes, communication obviously is key, and that may be an area that you can look at in terms of a program for parents.
Yeah, I'm always happy to talk with parents, for sure. You know, that is other work that I do, is, you know, kind of coaching parents around how to talk to their children and how to communicate. And you know, as you were talking about that, being the model, I think it's really important to notice that, you know, if you have areas where you're stuck, where, like, you can't stand up for yourself or you can't set boundaries, you know, your children are absorbing that. And so when they're in a situation where their own boundaries are crossed, you know, they're not as assured about being able to stand up for themselves.
Yes.
And it just reminded me of, you know, a story. I used to nanny and take care of this little girl, and I just remember there was this one day, and this guy, you know, just kind of was pretty rude to us, just randomly, you know, like at a store or whatever. And I just kind of turned to him and I said, you know, that's not okay. That's not all right with me that you just did that. And it was like months later, and her brother did something that was just not, you know, it was just like crossing the line of rude. And she just turned to him, she's three. Turns to him and says, that's not okay with me. And I just thought, right on, that is awesome, exactly. And that's exactly right. And with her, you know, I would say, look, if anyone ever touches you, I don't care who it is, even if it's me, if I do something that you don't like, you say no. And you tell me, and I would say, what if I tell you I don't believe you? What do you do? And she would say, and I taught her, I go and I tell somebody else. And what if that person doesn't believe you or says you're lying? I go and tell somebody else. Because, honestly, that's the hardest part for kids. A lot of times they come up and they get the courage to finally tell someone, and the person ignores it, doesn't believe it, blames them. So that's the other layer, is like not only teaching them to protect themselves, not only teaching them what to do, but giving them permission to basically tell on anyone, your dad, your mom, your grandparents, your brother, anybody. I don't care who it is. You talk to somebody, you talk until they listen.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, they say time flies when you're having fun. Would you believe, that we have been speaking for an hour already? We're almost at the end of this session. But is there anything you would like to say to listeners about your business? Certainly, I'm going to invite you to give the name and your web address again before we bring this to a close, but is there anything else you would like to say to anyone listening right now?
Well, I'll just throw out the little line that has carried me through a lot, which is, what you think, you create. So if you walk away with anything from anything that I've talked about today, it's to pay attention to your thoughts, to notice what is going on inside when you're responding to situations. What is that thought that's sitting there? Because that is at the root of what is driving your experience and what is driving how you see yourself and how you see other people. And when you take on, you know, rewiring your mind, getting
yes.
those things kind of unstuck, you really do create new possibilities and create a whole different experience for yourself. And that's, I love doing that work with my clients. You know, that's where we hit the ground running, is right there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not going to let you stay away from this program, Rachel. I am
Good.
Going to invite you back and from time to time. I want to know how you're getting on. I want to be right there when you go full time into your business, because you did say you're doing it part time at the moment. I want to be there when you launch other aspects of your business, when you write your book. Are you thinking of writing a book, perhaps?
It's in the process. I'm, you know, in chapter 3 or something. But I do blog. I do blog, so people can also look at the blog and kind of get little bits and pieces of the book. And
Good.
And basically a lot of the ideas are shared there on my blog, which they can get to from my website.
Very good. Well, speaking of website, could you please tell the listeners again how they can find you, the name of your company, again, your service?
So it's Rachel Grant Coaching, and the website is rachelgrantcoaching.com. And Rachel is just R-A-C-H-E-L, no A. And, yeah, go check out the website. Read about it. There are testimonials up there from past clients. And sign up for a free discovery session. There's nothing to lose from that. It just gives us an opportunity to talk and for me to get to know you a little bit. And, you know, there's no obligation for that. And, again, you know, all new clients right now are getting 4 free sessions. So that's an awesome deal. So I hope to hear from people. And if anyone wants just resources, email me. I'm always happy to just share, you know, if you're looking for a book on something or you need a group in your area, do get in touch with me.
Very good, very good. Well, unfortunately, we have come to the end of another fascinating discussion. You can also find information on Rachel on our website, which is eradiobroadcast.ning.com. Her links are there, going back to her website. And I want to thank you very much, Rachel, for joining us this evening on Fight Back. We certainly appreciate your contributions.
Oh, it's been totally my pleasure, Charles. Thank you so much.
Pleasure is all mine. I would